Well, nowadays this is not a problem because the computers are so fast and we have practically unlimited storage space. So we can take samples as frequently as we like. But usually it's a good rule of thumb that you should not use lower than 500 Hz sampling rate when you are doing EEG. And if you are doing EMG, it's usually wise to use even 2000. What would I record doing? Are you recording EMG?
Yeah.
So are you using 200? 2000 Hz sampling rate or 1000?
I can't remember, but I think 2000.
Yeah, we do that. Also, we use EEG and EMG at the same time, so we are using 1000 Hz sampling rate. So it means that it takes 1000 samples per second, one in every millisecond. It's also good to have that because then it's very straightforward in doing your analysis with MATLAB because you know that if you have an array of 1,000 samples, it's going to be 1 second. But if you if here's your frequency of interest and you have too low sampling rate, you can even have either have a flat line as in the example of the body temperature, or you may have been generated a signal that just isn't there in the first place. That's called undersampling. And it results in aliasing. All right. So, what does the analog to digital converter do? So there are two things that contributes to the resolution of this. One was the sampling rate. How many times per second it's going to take a sample of the signal. But the other thing is the bit rate of the AD converter. And I think this is easily explained so that if we think we have a one-bit system, which would be absurd, but let's just consider that. We have an AD converter that has one bit of information. And you probably know that the bit refers to binary information. It can be only 0 or 1. So we have a 1000 Hz sampling rate. Every millisecond the system is taking a sample of the analog signal in 1-bit resolution. So what we would end up with is would be a signal that's either 0 or 1. That might be sufficient in some cases, but usually it's very poor representation of the signal shape itself. So, if we have a 2-bit system, we have 4 possible states of recording. So, this would be 0. Let's say that our a voltage range would be from, let's say, 0 to 10. This would be 0, 2.5 volts, 5, 7.5, and 10. So that would be very crude. But usually if we think about 16-bit system, so there will be 16 numbers here, and you can think of this many combinations of different 0 and 1 patterns that could represent all possible steps here. So then you would actually have a very good resolution in that voltage scale. Are you following me? So let's say that we have the range is 20 volts, like minus 10 to plus 10. And you have that many possibilities to describe how high the signal is, or how low it is. So then you can divide this 20 volts by this number, which would be something like 40,000 and something, and you would end up with this resolution. And given that your signal was amplified by a factor of maybe 5,000, 10,000 perhaps, you would be able to describe it very well. So there are two things that contribute to the resolution of the signal. First is the sampling rate, which gives you this, the width of this step, and the bit rate, which gives you the width of that step. But in any case, the digital signal is a step-like thing. If you magnify it large enough, it's not a smooth line as an analog signal. It just goes from one point and then this next point, and there's no continuity between them. Of course, we can draw a continuity between them. But as a matter of fact, we don't know what happens during this time point, because we have not sampled that. But we can assume that the signal was going from here to here. Is this clear?
Yeah.
But this, like the sampling rate thing, this is not that much of an issue nowadays, because computers are fast and capable. So I think this slide is maybe 10 years old now. So it might be that nowadays they are 24-bit systems, so it's even more fine-grained. And the larger bit rate you can have in the idea, maybe we reach a point sometime that we don't need to amplify the signal anymore at all, because the resolution of the system would be so high that even a minute change in the signal itself would be able to be represented by the system. We are not there yet, but it's possible. Well, this is obvious. Of course, the computer doesn't store the signal itself. So, as opposed to these plotters that draw a line to a paper, computers don't do that. They just store array of numbers coming from the AD converter. In most systems, of course, this can be displayed during the recording. You can even do some online signal processing as you are doing your recordings. Which is of course nice if you are designing something that's called brain-computer interface. When something happens in the person's brain, you can make the experiment do something else as a response to the person. Or you can record brain activity in the motor cortex of a paralyzed person to see that his intention was to move something, and you can have an actuator that actually moves like something. Or a mouse cursor is a very good example of this. But what we just discussed with the filtering also applies here. Anytime you do something with the signal, it's going to take some time. Filters operate in time, so your signal will be delayed, so you can't respond immediately, no matter how fast your system is. Okay, that much for the acquisition system. So was this all familiar to you? Any new information here? So that's how the recording goes on. I don't think we need to deal with this very extensively. But of course, one of the, let's talk about the signal qualities itself. So that's it. Oh no, I have some slides in a bit peculiar order. Okay, let's talk about EEG for a while. So Hans Berger, this is probably very familiar to you. In 29, blah blah blah, Hans Berger showed that there's a rhythmic oscillation that can be recorded from a person's head, in this case his own son. Very common scientist, very typical scientist using his own son as a subject of the experiment. He attached the electrode in the back of his son's head and recorded the oscillatory activity while he was doing something. And he was able to demonstrate that whenever the son closed his eyes, there was a rhythmic activity, and he called that alpha activity. And whenever he opened his eyes, that activity was gone. So that is kind of the first observation that you can actually record something that comes from the brain by using this non-invasive external electrodes. Nowadays, of course, we think it's pretty obvious, but maybe it was less obvious in his days. And of course, this is a very, from the perspective of cognitive neuroscience, it's of course very important. Because it actually seems that when he was resting, I don't know whether they knew by that time that visual cortex relies on the, in the back of the head, maybe they did. But whenever there was no input, you could see the alpha activity. When there was input, the alpha activity was gone. So we could infer that we can record something that relates to a person's cognitive tasks as a function of time by recording this scalp EEG. Okay, enough with the dead old man. The dead old man approach. But there's usually a gallery of dead old men in every introductory lecture. Sorry, so let's not break up the tradition. But since the times of Berger, of course, there has been lots of progress in this field. Berger termed the oscillatory 10 Hz activity as alpha activity because it was the first phenomenon that was found. And later on, they found something that leads to beta activity that is related to cognitive load or cognitive functioning. And of course, after that, we have seen lots of different activity patterns related to different cognitive aspects, especially to sleep and states of consciousness. But let's not talk about them right now. How many of you have not recorded EEG ever? Okay. Have you been to a lab? Well, this is the international system that is used to guide where we place the electrodes, but of course, nowadays you have these caps that you just align, and then the person puts that on his or her head, and they are automatically more or less correct locations. But whenever you are reading a paper where someone says that they recorded ERPs from the CZ electrode, it refers to that one. And of course, the modern signal processing is now going towards not to use these electrodes as the source of information. We are first trying to grasp, to make the source reconstruction so that we know where the signal is coming from in the brain. We are talking about electrode level recordings and or analysis, source analysis. Electrode level analysis would be that we are saying that we are recording from this electrode and that signal did this and that. But on the source level, we are going to say that we recorded with a very high density array of electrodes, and then we did some magic, and then we say that this comes from the superior temporal sulcus. So we are going to do the analysis on the source level. This is very common in MEG recordings, not so common in EEG. MEG is better if you want to do the source localization, but it can be done in EEG too. All right. So the other half of the coin is the recording. How to measure something, how to convert the signal into digital thing that you can store. But the other side of the lab surrounding is the control of the experiment. And this is, of course, has lots to do with the experimental designs. And of course, computers are nowadays doing this too. I was last autumn I visited Cambridge, and they have this kind of museum-like thing in the lobby of the psychology department. And they had in these display cases, they had all kinds of ancient devices. And one of the devices was very clever. It had a rotating drum with contact surfaces, and there's a motor that rotated the drum in a steady pace. And whenever this metal thing hit the lead, it gave the pulse that's duration was determined by the width of this plate. And there was no timing issues whatsoever, provided that this drum was just going on a steady pace. Computers, on the other hand, do have timing issues, but they are not considered that bad. Well, there are some. Even though I say here that timing of stimuli and event is precise and consistent, it's not always the case when we are doing something that runs on Windows. Because Windows tend to do all kinds of things, even if we didn't want the system to do those things. But the processor is doing lots of things. It's like our brain, doing lots of things at any given moment. When I was doing my master's thesis, like some time ago, we didn't have Windows on the system. I can assure you we didn't have any timing issues whatsoever. Every trial started exactly when we started. And the computers was... I mean, your watch probably has more power than the computers back then. Maybe even our toasters. Well, anyway.
How long did it go?
Pantrix.
What system did you use?
It was, have you ever heard about, it was PC 386.
Yeah.
DX. There was SX and DX, and DX was the, It had something like 1 megabyte of RAM. But the thing is that everything that computer did was the controlling of my experiment and nothing else. So that's very accurate. But in any case, one benefit of using computer to control the experiment is, of course, that you can get rid of human source of error. If you do something like playing with some stimuli yourself, it could go wrong horribly. But computers are stupid, they just do what we program them to do. Of course, if you program them to do something stupid, they are doing really stupid things. So you have to be very careful. And of course, the timing is consistent. Well, kind of. So every trial is exactly the same. Some recordings require a lot of imagination, both of the researcher and the lab technician. So if you want to control something that's timed very accurately, like how would you record evoked responses evoked by an order, how would you create a system so that it would be very, now it's on, now it's off. And maybe this doesn't bear any relevance whatsoever, but if you were interested in a similar fashion that you are interested in auditory evoked potential, it's very easy to record. Just play a tone and see what the brain does. But the onset of something like an order is a bit more tricky to control for. There are many software packages available for doing this. We have been using E-Prime, which has issues. Nowadays, I think we are turning into presentation and psychopy. The good thing about E-Prime is that, have you seen that? It's graphical, so you just put objects after object, and then you see the front of this. It's very easy to... and very intuitive to program. Whereas presentation is actually like MATLAB. It's a command line thing. You just type in your code and then it, or script, and then it does that. These are commercial software, so a bit annoying thing about this is that we can't say to a number like 40 people, let's do this with E-Prime, because we don't have the licenses for that. Let's rehearse this in a classroom. But there are also open source software like PsychoPy that runs both on, it's written in Python, for the Pi. But it's also graphical for the most part. Relatively easy to use. But of course something, as usually the open source software is that sometimes they don't work with different devices and whatever. But it's been developed by enthusiasts, so if you have issues you just contact them and they usually are very eager to help. And something in between is that, well, MATLAB itself is commercial, but Psych Toolbox is coded by some researcher, and you can use that for free. Well, those software can be used to control for the experiment, and some of the stimuli, well, most of the stimuli can be played with a computer itself, like texts, pictures, videos, sounds, tones. But it's also crucial to have external devices that produce something, like if you are interested in somatosensory stimulation, of course your computer cannot provide that stimulus. As it just use a pulse that the computer generates in order to put some other device on. Well, there are in pictures and pictorial stimuli, there are some standardized picture sets that are available. For instance, for emotion research, we have the IAPS, the International Affective Picture Set, developed by Peter Lang and his lab. But one thing to remember with visual stimuli is that if you do present them in a computer screen, you are going to have some issues with the refreshing rate of the computer display itself, because it's very common that it refreshes its picture 60 times per second. So every, is it something like 40 milliseconds apart? So if you want to record good visual evoked potentials, you have to make sure that the picture is there exactly at the point when you send the pulse now, so the picture, so the picture. Because otherwise there will be a jitter and your earpiece will be a mess. Do you know what the what is a tachistoscope? A small way of going around this. You would have, do you remember the slide projector with diode? What are they in English? With those small things, that, the plastic things that you put in.
Slide projector.
Slide projector, yes. Of course, that doesn't have any refresh rate issues, because that's constantly there, it's light. Well, one way of making it's very sure that you, if you want to show people with subliminal images, so they would notice that they are being shown something, you would have to flash the figure very fast. So you could use something like a tachistoscope. It's like the shutter in the camera. If you press a button, it opens for a very brief moment. And it, I know maybe there is a way of doing this with a computer, but I think the safest way of doing this is just to use the mechanical shutter device that blocks the view to a slide of a slide projector, and then it opens up just for a while to expose the person to the image.
Is it possible with a video, with a program that can, in a video, you can insert a few milliseconds of
yes, but if you want to be sure that it's just, if you want to record brain responses to that, you need to know exactly when it was there. And we talk about jitter. If you have a pulse that now something happens, and it actually happens maybe 5, 10, 15, 12 milliseconds after that. And if you then do the ERP analysis, the onset won't be like that, but it will be like this. And it will distort the signal. So that's my point here. That if you want to make sure, you would either have to rely on digital things so that this issue has been taken care of, and this flickering of this image is always in the consistent relationship with the trigger signal itself, then you're okay. But I don't know how to measure that. They have a very high-end projector in the Meg lab, so I think this should be possible there. But it's tricky. If you want to be 100% sure that something happens without this jitter, than mechanical devices, the way to go. Yeah. Actually, I found one of those things in the when we were making a previous move from the MAC building to there. I found this one string operated shutter that it just pulled a string and it would open up like that. So if you connected that with a computer that has a solenoid, which would trigger the tachistoscope, then you would have very accurate and you put a tire, this a slide protector on behind, in behind of this, then you would have idiot-proof system. But don't call to Simo and tell that you want this in the Meg lab. All right.
You should cut.
Hi, Simo. Yeah. Then how about somatosensory stimulation? Of course, the most obvious and easiest way of doing this is the electrical stimulation. Downside of that is that it generates artifacts in electrical recordings. So there might be some instances that you don't want to use that. But it's very easy. You just put electrodes on someone's skin, and then you put some current there. And if you do that with a strong enough current, you can induce pain, which is sometimes a good thing because you want to record pain responses. But usually it's just used for something happened, and a person can say that something happened on my skin. Of course, you can use air for this. It has this onset time issue, though, that is not like on and off. Because when you use air, it tends to compress, and then, like, air is very soft material. So if you put air in a tube from here, what happens in a 3 meter long tube is that the air compresses, and then it goes like this. So it has a delay until the effect takes place. You could use vibration. One very nice example of this was done in Helsinki when they had a balloon attached to a subwoofer, which was generating very low tones so that people couldn't hear them. But when they put their hand on the balloon, it generated some vibration. And I was, in my first paper in my PhD work, I had this somatosensory stimulation in rabbits, and a visiting professor of us actually suggested that I go to this adult toy shop and buy a thing from there, which I then could attach to our system and put that to vibrate on the rabbit's back. I was quite shy and didn't do it, so I had to rely on the air pump.
What a genius.
Yeah. But the thing is that you have to be very creative when you are setting up an experiment. Don't overlook anything. I always say that today that we run out of duct tape and super glue, the science is over. Okay, well, usually the computer is used to trigger external devices by using this. In the old days it was parallel port on serial port, and not just in the old days, we are still doing that because they are easy to operate with. But of course there are Ethernet connection, TCP or whatever, but it could be used for the signaling too. But in practice, if we are talking about this serial or parallel port, we send 5 volt pulses from the computer to some device that detects that there's a voltage. Now I should do something. So we can operate external devices by that, like these air valves attached to pressurized air bottles. There's a valve that operates on 5 volts, and when we put the signal, it opens up and lets the air go through. Or solenoids, so they are kind of like motors that move something. You can move or control movements with computer. And the MATLAB is very well equipped with all imaginable devices nowadays. So I think all the, if you want to do something, it's just up to your own imagination how to do it. I think they are ready. Of course, this signal generated by the control computer is also used to tag events that happens. If you just record brain activity and afterwards you wouldn't have any information of what happened and when it happened, your data would be useless unless you are interested in ongoing activity. But and there's always this issue that this tag signal should be happening simultaneously with the actual event. So I was referring to this jitter. So if there is a jitter of the pulse goes in to the recording system saying that now something happens, and that something happens on a varying interval after the pulse onset, then you have a problem. I mean, 2 or 3 milliseconds jitter is not catastrophic in normal settings, but it can be in some circumstances. There are some instances, but not always. But if it goes beyond that, it's a potential problem. All right. I think this is. Well, maybe I'll just go through these two slides and then we have a break. And let's continue with in there. And let's do something with MATLAB after that. But now for the signal processing itself.